So the holiday season is in full swing, and we hope you'll be spending time and meals with people you love. And maybe you're getting ready to have some of those people over. Well, we've put together a show that's all about people coming together. We've got an incredible story about the power of an invitation, and we'll hear about how Julia Child helped to remake the American dinner party by insisting that the cook get to be part of the fun. But first, we're going to go to Georgia, the country. On the Black Sea between Russia and Turkey, it's got a fascinating cuisine, and it's thought to be the birthplace of wine, so you know their feast traditions are for real. Carla Capalbo spent years writing a book called Tasting Georgia, and she's here to talk with us about those traditions. Carla, thank you so much for coming in today.
It's really a pleasure to be here and to meet you.
The same, the same. So I would love to learn about the food of Georgia, the Republic of Georgia. Now, if you look on a map, Georgia sits in a part of the world that's between Russia to the north and Turkey to the south, and also borders Armenia and Azerbaijan. But it's fascinating to me because I don't think of Russian food, or what I think of as Russian food, as anything really alike what I think of as Turkish food. So does the food of Georgia sit in between those two, and does it look like either of them?
Well, Georgia is, I always think of Georgia as this sort of beautiful creature that sits between Turkey and countries further south than that, of course, Persia or Iran as well, and Russia. And what Georgia has that the others don't have is this ability to grow. It has a sort of abundance, a natural abundance, both in terms of its beautiful climate, but also it's very fertile. And so it's able to grow all the things that the other countries sort of long for, and particularly Russia longs for, i.e. grapes for wine. And, you know, the exotic spring fruits that we all love, like yellow cherries and wild strawberries and things like that. And I think that Georgian food also has had a lot of influences because it was kind of in that central position between the Black Sea, of course, as well. And so it had, you know, invasions from every direction over its long and troubled history. But it kind of, instead of taking away from what the Georgians had, that enriched the Georgian food culture.
Yeah, and can you tell me about some of the key dishes, or what are some of the key flavors there?
Well, one of the interesting things about Georgian food, first of all, is that they love the complexity of serving not just one dish at a time, but a group of dishes at a time. You wouldn't just have a single dish. I mean, you might if you were at home, but normally if you're having dinner with friends, let's say, there would always be at least four or five dishes. And when you move up to what's called the supra, or the feast, you would have upwards of 10 or could be 12 different dishes all appearing on the table more or less at the same time. And so there's a kind of orchestra, really, orchestration of flavors and textures, you know, which could go from rather sour. There's a lamb stew that I love, which is made with tarragon and bitter greens like arugula and sometimes nettles and radish tops. But it also has sour plums in it.
Oh, wow.
And it's really exceptional. But that kind of bounces off the hachapuri, which is the famous cheesy bread that everybody loves about Georgian food.
So take us to this Georgian feast table, the supra table. You said you might have 10 dishes. Maybe the cheese bread is on one end of it. This beautiful lamb stew is another. What other dishes might be on that table?
Okay, one of the things that I was fascinated by when I first started going to Georgia was actually the way these, what I call the supra tables, actually look. So whereas in our country you would sit down to a table that might be laid with knives and forks, there wouldn't be any food on the table already. Whereas in Georgia you sit down to a table that's already abundant with food. And the dishes that would already be on the table would be many of the vegetable dishes, because they're often served at room temperature or sometimes even chilled. And many of those will have walnut sauces. You know, the walnuts are a very important key ingredient in Georgian cuisine, and they pound them. The women still, I mean, there are some men, but let's say mostly women cooks, pound the walnuts with a mortar and pestle, and then they pound tons and tons and tons of fresh herbs. I mean, really handfuls of cilantro and opal basil and mint and dill. It's really a very very lively flavors from all of this. And what's also very lovely about it is that if it's a long table, supposing you've got 25 or 30 people sitting at a super table, which you easily could, the dishes are never just like one big bowl of something. There'll be little dishes that'll be placed along the table so that you as the guest never have to reach very far to actually have all of the different things that are being presented at this feast. So you'd have your vegetable dishes. You might have some cheeses sliced. You definitely have fermented vegetables or even blossoms. It's very interesting. They love
flowers.
Something from, yeah, flowers.
Wow.
And they take the clusters of flowers from the acacia tree or else something that's called the bladdernut bush, which they call jonjoli.
It's prettier in Georgian.
Yes, jonjoli is lovely. And it looks a little bit like a lilac cluster, really. But they trim those from the plant. They pluck them, really, just before the little blossoms open because they don't want any bugs inside. And then they put them in jars or crocks with salt. So it's a very sort of simple fermentation method. But so they come out almost tasting like pickles, but without the vinegarness.
Right.
And then they'll dress a little dish of those with sliced raw onion and a little bit of lemon juice sometimes as well. And then when you sit down, little by little, the hot dishes come. So that's when you might be served the stews or a chicken with a garlic sauce or the dumplings, which are quite extraordinary, which are called khinkali. And they have sort of soup dumplings, but you hold them up almost like as if you were holding a mushroom by its stem, and you bite gingerly on the side and you suck out the hot broth and then you chew your way into the center. So
cool.
All of those hot dishes will come afterwards.
And there's a lot of toasting that happens at the supra. Can you talk to me about the role of the toastmaster?
The tamada. He's called the tamada. It's almost always a man. And at any gathering, even if I go to visit, let's say, a winemaker's family and we are all sitting together having a supper or a small supra, it's usually the older man, the oldest man at the table, but not necessarily sort of the head person in any case in the room, will be nominated as that evening's tamada. And the tamada's role is, particularly at the bigger supras, is to make toasts that are often in a sequence. For instance, in Guria, which is a region near the Black Sea, the first toast is always to peace. In other places, it might be to God or the family. Mm. And but there are certain subjects that come up, which will always be part of it. So if you're a guest, for instance, there will always be a toast to the guest. And what I find really beautiful about this is that it's never just the guest for the person who's here. It wouldn't just be you, Francis. Mm-hmm. It might be. They'd be very delighted to have you here. But they would say, this is a toast for our guests and for Francis. But it's also for Francis's family and the people who he's close to. And even maybe the people who are no longer with us in this world, but who have been part of his life. And so that kind of embrace that you get from those toasts is something that I've always found very moving.
That's super interesting. It sounds like there is a real emphasis on not just the individual people, but the communities we're all connected to.
Exactly.
And it sounds like, okay, so if the supra is this traditional feast, and it sounds like there are these, in a sense, rules, but maybe it's sort of ritualistic almost elements to it, of the toasting, of the way the food is presented. Is there a symbolism to the fact, you've mentioned a few times, when you get to the feast, the table is already laid in with food. Is there a symbolism to that?
I don't know if there's a symbolism exactly, but there certainly is, I think, a symbolism to the use of the wine at the table. Because for the Georgians, wine is a food as well, but it's a food that connects them to God. You know, they're Orthodox Christian is the religion there, and people are very involved in, as you say, both community, but also a sense that eating and drinking is one of the principal things in life that, you know, and so you're there to have a good time. I mean, it's not a sort of somber at all sort of a thing. It's very jolly. And one of the most wonderful parts about it as well is, especially if you're at a big supra, is that you might find that the four people who are sitting next to you will suddenly just burst into song. And there's a lot of singing. And the singing, of course, is this polyphonic singing, which is very beautiful and a little discordant. So it literally makes, sometimes when they start, it makes the hairs at the back of your neck stand up in of excitement. And so, again, there's a sense of the party is really something very moving and involving. And when you feel sort of initiated really into the culture of Georgia when you go to one.
Yeah. So wine, song, and food. That's what life is all about. Thank you so much for coming in today, Carla.
Thank you so much.
Carla Capalbo is author of Tasting Georgia, A Food and Wine Journey in the Caucasus. And you can find Carla's recipe for that delicious cheesy bread called kachapuri at splendidtable.org.